Hello and welcome to BioRossi's Few and Far Between podcast. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. Today's guest knows the importance of harmony, performance, and taking the lead in the clinical trial industry. Diana Sims Silberman began her career as a talented opera singer at Juilliard. Upon her move to Germany, she switched tracks to medicine and then focused in on roles in clinical research, from PI to senior trial manager at Janssen Pharmaceuticals. Across her tenure, she has remained an inquisitive observer and skilled facilitator for clinical trials in Europe, with a keen understanding of regulatory requirements and patient centricity. I hope you enjoy our conversation and Diana's insights into the ever-evolving global clinical trials market. Okay, let's start the podcast. Okay, welcome, Diana. Welcome to Few and Far Between. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So, Diana, you came highly recommended to me by Dr. Francisco Harrison, a previous guest of ours. And what he said to me at the time was, you should speak with Diana. She has a strong point of view on clinical research. She's been observing it over the course of her career, and she's going to have a lot to say. So let's start with that career. So how did you begin your career? Can we go back to the very beginning and talk a little bit about the path that led you to clinical research?
Yes. Well, let's go back even a little farther. Okay. My first life, I studied music. I was an opera singer. And I moved to Germany because of that career. And I sang professionally on many opera stages in Germany for the course of over 5 years. And during that time, I met my husband. And I also realized that although I had won many prizes in America and had studied at Juilliard, had a Metropolitan Opera Scholarship, etc., my voice was really not big enough to make a huge international career. So I decided that I would get out of professional music and do something else with my life as long as I was young enough to start something new. So I had very good grades in college. I went to UCLA before I went to Juilliard. And my husband, who is a dentist, encouraged me to apply for medical school, which I did, and I got in. So I studied medicine in Germany. I got my certification, and then I got my board certification in general medicine, anesthesia, and emergency medicine, and worked many years in the hospital as a physician.
Diana, how did you come by your German? Did you speak German when you started medical school?
In preparation, as when if you really are studying seriously opera, you've got to have good functioning knowledge of several languages, French, Italian, and German, because the repertoire is written basically in those languages. So I did have basic knowledge. And a year before I moved to Germany, I did an auditioning tournée and I got a contract in Germany. So I had a year to prepare myself. So I did then study. I did okay in German. You know, I was able to make myself understood when I came here.
Okay. Your degree was in German? Coursework was in German?
Oh, yes. I wrote my doctoral thesis in German. And also,
yeah.
Because in Germany, it's a different situation. You do not get your title as doctor of medicine unless you write a doctoral thesis. In America, you become a doctor with the ending of your medical school. That is not the case in Germany. And so there are physicians that are not Dr. Med. So I did write my thesis in German. I had somebody correct it, of course. My written German will never be perfect. German is really difficult.
So you, like most people, you say maybe not opera and instead medicine. And so you just casually enroll in medical school and go through that process in Germany. And then what happened?
Well, I started studying medicine very late. I was 32 when I started studying.
Uh-huh.
And then around the time that I was like 56, 57, I was still doing, you know, night duties and riding the ambulance. We have an emergency set up in Germany such that we don't have paramedics. When somebody calls 911 or it's 110 here, you get a doctor. So I rode the ambulance also for many years. But, you know, it got to be a little much at that age. So I started kind of looking around for something else. And I applied to be an investigator at that time, now extinct, but a very large CRO in the area of Düsseldorf where I live. And so I was accepted. So I stopped working in the hospital. I started working in the CRO and I really liked it. It was a completely different medical experience than treating patients. A real mindset, Jane.
Tell us a little bit about that. So
yes.
Expand on that if you would a little. What was the mindset?
That's a very good topic. When you're a treating physician. Your aim is to make people healthy, to give them medicines, and to monitor, of course, their progress. If the lab values a little under, a little over, you're looking at trends. You're not looking at exact numbers. When you're doing a clinical trial, your main aim is to keep the patients healthy. You don't want them to get sick or have side effects or too many side effects when you're doing. So you're trying to keep them healthy instead of making them healthy. Yes?
Yeah.
And also the precision, this was a CRO that did phase 1 trials. So you have to be extremely exact. And when you take the blood pressure, you don't take it at 132 or 138. You take it at 133, if that's 5 minutes after you gave person their dosing. Another way of looking at medicine and having to adhere to very strict in an exclusion criteria, very strict if somebody's hemoglobin goes up 2 points above what's allowed, you know, they're out of the study or it's a big deal. And if you're being a curative physician, it's not going to bother you that much. You know, if QTC is a little bit longer or the hemoglobin is a little bit under, but in clinical trials, that's a completely different situation. I had to learn that. And again, mainly the thing, you're trying to keep the patients healthy, giving them medicine and hoping that they don't have any side effects or, you know, they don't have to drop out of the study, you know, and that everything is done according to an extremely strict protocol.
How did you respond to that? Was that, did you find that restricting? Did you find it exciting? Like, what was that like? I think we may have some listeners who might be physicians who are considering clinical research.
It's just a mindset. You just have to look at medicine from a different standpoint. And you've got to, you know, knock it out of your head that it doesn't matter if the temperature is a little bit higher, the blood pressure is a little bit lower. It matters a lot in a clinical trial because you're gathering data that's going to be go into a dossier that's going to be sent to regulatory authorities so that the medication will get market approval. And stakeholders depend on exactly what happens. You know, that extra degree or extra milliliters makes a lot of difference.
Terrific. Okay, so there you are.
Easy for me to look at the clock and to wait until the second man was on 12 and say, swallow the pill. Yeah.
Maybe your musical training was highly relevant there. Precision, right?
No, it's a different mindset. It's a different mindset. But I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. It prompted me then to do a master's in pharmaceutical medicine at the University of Essen, which I did. And that was a 2-year training while working sort of situation. And I learned a tremendous amount of that. I'm now a lecturer in that program.
That's another fascinating twist in your journey. What made you decide you needed to pursue that additional training?
Well, because I liked what I was doing and I wanted to know more about it. And it just so happened as I started to do this, I got sort of headhunted from the CRO that I was working at by Johnson & Johnson because they needed someone to manage their phase 1 trials in Germany.
Yeah.
And I was the ideal candidate for that. So I got that job. And then I was taking this master's course, which was just wonderful because it gave me the big picture. It wasn't just about clinical trials. It about statistics, marketing, safety, regulatory affairs. I mean, the whole big picture of pharmaceutical industry. So after having that course, you know, I knew why the PK analysis was coming and tearing his hair out because of this or that. You know, I understood where it was coming from, you know?
Yeah, it gave you the full picture. What was it like moving to J&J after having been in a CRO for a long time, moving to the other side of the table?
It was a big change because working in a different kind of team and a different kind of environment. At that time, CRO case report form, CRFs were paper.
Yeah, right.
And there weren't any big, huge data banks like there are now. And those are the things I had to learn in the 15 years that I was at J&J. But it was simpler. Regulatory authorities, ethics commissions were less demanding. Mm-hmm. I guess Big Brother wasn't watching them that like they are now. Mm-hmm. But it was learning a new set of skills, actually.
Yeah.
You know, I had to learn monitoring. I had to learn from the other side, which is the thing that helped me immensely. Having come from the doing side of a clinical trial, I went to the management side.
Yeah.
So I understood all the problems that occur or arise when a clinical trial is being conducted. You know, knowing what to watch out for, being able to explain why we have to do it the way we have to do it, why the protocol is written the way it is. So that was an immense help.
Diana, do you think that's necessary in order to perform those jobs, managing a CRO, managing clinical trials?
It's not.
having been a practitioner, how important is that?
Oh, it's a big help. I mean, it's not necessary because I will say very few of my colleagues, although there are a number of study nurses that go into big pharma as site managers, for instance, and they do rise to very good positions. So it's extremely helpful. It's extremely helpful, but it's not mandatory.
Got it. So your combination of experiences running the phase one trials inside J&J, working inside CROs, your educational background, it does give you this sort of sweeping kind of maybe bird's eye view on the clinical trial process. Can you talk a little bit about how regulation and regulators have changed over the course of your career? You mentioned Big Brother wasn't watching so much when you started. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe the pros and cons?
Sure. When I started getting approvals to conduct a trial from the regulatory or approvals from the ethics commissions was just much simpler. Today, you don't get an approval right away. The protocol always come back with pages of questions and requests for clarity. The ethics commissions almost never approve an informed consent form on the first time around.
Immediately. Yeah. Why do you think that's changed?
It has to do with patient centricity. It has to do with the voice of the patient becoming louder, which is correct. But also, I think everybody wants to be important. Everybody.
Right. Well, if you ask someone for comments, they tend to give them to you.
They're cleaning up the process in Europe. They're making central applications now so that it was, for instance, in Germany, there were 57 different ethics committees.
Wow.
And depending on who you were submitted to, they all had their own ideas about, let us say, what is red, what is blue. Well, that's a little bit more pink. No, that's a little bit too purple. I mean, no, they'd find thing. One ethics committee would say, no, you can't say it that way. And the other ethics committee said, you have to say it that way.
Yeah.
So it's very, very difficult for the sponsor.
This is one of those things that I think if you haven't spent time in clinical research might shock people. Because people would assume, look, it's highly analytical people. There ought to be standardized ways of thinking about these things. And in fact, as you say, it's different shades of pink in many cases.
Yeah. I mean, just as an example, the way contraception is presented in ICF, it's a very important thing because, of course, we want to avoid people that get pregnant during a trial because many times you just don't know enough about the drug, the investigational product, to know if it's going to be teratogene, you know, in some way harm the fertility or a growing fetus. So that's a big issue. And what kind of birth control and how long you have to have taken it before you enter the trial. I mean, those things get so complicated. But I guess people have had experiences and don't want to get burned because, you know, the readiness for people to sue is huge. I mean, I've had lawsuits from trials. You know, people have, especially in phase one trials where you're dealing with healthy volunteers, yeah, where you don't have a big medical record and you have to go on what they say. Yes, I'm healthy. No, I haven't been in the hospital in the last 3 months. And it turns out they were very ill and they have an exacerbation of their illness, be it mental or physical. And all of a sudden they'll sue you and say that was because of the medication that's being tested.
Hi, this is Chris O'Brien, host of Few and Far Between. We'll be right back with this episode in a moment. I personally want to thank you for listening to our podcast. Now, in our third season, it continues to be an amazing opportunity to speak with some of the top thought leaders in the clinical trials industry. If you're enjoying this episode, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps people discover the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to Few and Far Between so that you never miss an episode. One last request. Know someone with a great story you'd like to hear me interview? Reach out to us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com. Thank you. And now, back to the podcast. As you said, there's some real good that comes from patient centricity, voice of the patient.
Definitely.
And incorporating that into trial design and into informed consent and how we think about all of these things. And then there is risk aversion. There is the desire to be important. There are all these other factors that can also slow down approvals. How do you think about that? Or how should regulators try to balance those needs?
Well, I think they should be more conformed. They should decide certain rules, regulations, guidelines, and stick to them. There's always going to be local or national diversions. I mean, within the EU, there are, you know, and of course, if you look at China or Korea, where everything has to be written in Korean or Chinese. That slows things up a bit. Yeah. And guidelines on, especially with international trials, you're working with different ethnicities. There should be more strict guidelines across nations on how many Asians you need to establish the PK data from an Asian population. You know, it doesn't work when China does it one way and Korea does it the other way and Thailand does it the other way and Europe does it the other way.
Yeah. So more standardization. And obviously, we live in an imperfect world. We're probably not going to have perfect standardization across all these different countries. I guess this means you support the standardized application processes in Europe and the
definitely
into one standard there. Is that right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
And another big issue is data protection.
Yeah.
Because we have this big problem with Europe and America. And that's another thing that holds trials up is what can be transferred from Europe to America and how it has to be anonymisiert, pseudo-anonymisiert. You can't use initials anymore, of course. It used to be you could use initials. That doesn't work.
Right. We have to anonymize these data and according to very strict standards. And as you say, there even are challenges. I'm saying this for folks who may not be familiar with this. There are very strict restrictions on even exporting data within a company, but outside of Europe, for example.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the company I work for, Johnson & Johnson, of course, international, and our PK analysis and so was all in America. So the biopsies and the samples and stuff, they were being analyzed there. So we had that problem constantly. And another big thing that's complicated is the digital world because of the fact that more or less everybody is transparent and hackers are hacking everything. And, you know, I mean, how safe can safe be?
Right. Let's talk about that. Let's move to the digitization of healthcare. You've had a bird's eye view of this going from paper CRFs and other paper forms when you started to the world that we live in now. Are there negatives you see to the digitization? Let's talk a little bit about that and then we'll talk about some of the positives. Some of the positives are obvious, but interested to hear more about that too.
Positives I could talk about too, but negative is the fact that always coming new systems, and they don't always correspond with each other.
Yeah.
And it is more than nerve-wracking to have to put the same data into more than one system.
Yeah.
And time-consuming. A terrible burden on employees. Certainly not conducive to avoiding errors. What happens if you make a typo and then you're putting the same blood pressure, one little digit difference into two different systems? You know, query. And that's the problem. Of course, advantages are carry tons of paper around and you can share. You can do monitoring digitally at home. You don't have to travel to the centers as a monitor constantly. Data, it can be seen in real time, which is naturally vital if, you know, everything is on a timeline in pharma. So it speeds things up amazingly.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got to be savvy. And there's a lot of training involved, just training a clinical staff. Just think of a clinical staff doing trials for Novartis and Janssen and Roche, and they all have their own systems, and each is a little bit different, and you have another password. And, I mean, it gets complicated.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about that, that the amount of time people have to spend on systems training must be dramatically higher than it was 15 years ago.
Huge.
Yeah.
I mean, we get bombarded with trainings and we're required, of course, not to slip behind in our training catalog when a new training comes along and they come along several times a week, you know, you had to do it. You had to do it on top of your, and yes, that is a burden. You know, I mean, it's like you get the feeling the wheel keeps getting reinvented. We gotta get just stopped for a while.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you look at the world, the clinical research world as it stands today, largely digitized, vast amounts of data collected, and then you look forward a little bit based on what you just said, you expect the pace of change to continue. What are some of the things that you think are interesting or exciting that might be happening, either that exist today but have not been fully adopted, or you think are coming in the near term in this world?
I think the most exciting thing in medicine coming up is personalized medicine. And the fact that it has already been realized that somebody who has colon cancer, they don't all get the same chemo because it doesn't work for every person, you know? And I think that's wonderful. The complication is you've got to develop a new medicine, then you have to develop a genetic test for that medicine so that you know who you can give it to. So that's more work. But I think that will bring medicine far, really far, you know, however that makes recruiting more difficult.
Right. Recruiting becomes a real challenge in this, in an end of one world, or something that gets closer to that. More tools will need to be developed. One of the things that I wanted to spend a few minutes on is the course of your career and advice that you might have, particularly for young people, because I think often the most interesting careers that people have are twisty. They don't follow a straight line. Yours certainly did not. I assume when you were 20, you did not expect that you would be...
Never.
So do you have advice for young people who are considering either considering medicine and or clinical research or more broadly just embarking on adult life?
Well, my life experience been learn everything you can. You never know what's going to be good for you. My stage experience, for instance, was such a great help when I had to give presentations and I had to explain things to people and go to a center and initiate a new trial or give a lecture or even talk with professors at a university about upcoming trial or so. Communication is so important. But basically, everything you learn is good. You never know when you're going to need it. And every course and every opportunity you have to learn something, do it. Because you never know when it's going to help you.
I love that. Reminds me that now that you say this, of something that Dr. Harrison said about you. And he said that one of your great gifts was in communicating passion for a trial and the importance of the trial itself and the activities that were asking people to do in the trial. So any advice on communication, on how do you do that? How do you connect with people and convey the importance or the value in their work?
Okay. Johnson & Johnson let me take a really great course in how to prepare presentations and stuff. But the thing that I think is, don't try to be something you're not. Because there are people that have problems standing in front of people. And I've seen colleagues of mine who were really, at the beginning, really shy and very insecure when they had to say anything in front of people. Practice that and don't try to be something you're not. It's okay to be quiet and dignified and talk with a soft voice. You don't have to yell, you don't have to scream, and you don't have to move your hands around and make a whole show. But there's people, I'm a show person, I'll do that, you know. But you'll have more success if you're authentic and stay, work within what you are, you know?
So communicate in an authentic manner. That makes a lot of sense. How do you convince an audience to care about? This is obviously one of your strengths. How do you convince an audience to care about the thing that you care about?
I think showing them that you believe in it.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't act. You can't say, this is a great trial when you think it stinks, you know? You got to find something that's positive that you can commute, that's honest. Again, it's be yourself. Don't lie. Don't try to say something that you can't stand up to. Think about the positive. If you have to communicate a trial that you think is written poorly or something, you can say there might be better ways to do it, but this is a structure we have to work with, and let's find a way together to do this. And try to sell it. I mean, you know, used car salesmen can sell you a piece of junk, you know, they know how to do it.
Right, so it's sell it, but sell it in an authentic way, I guess, is the advice, right?
Yeah, you have to show that you believe in it, you know, because people will see through you, I think.
And last question, I guess, would you recommend to young people who are considering a career in life sciences, clinical research in some capacity?
Definitely. Definitely. In my age, I have a lot of our friends, I have kids, you know, that are in college or just finishing up masters or whatever and wondering what to do with it, you know. And I always say that clinical research pharmacology is a great venue, even if you're a lawyer or a biologist. I mean, for instance, people who study biology or chemistry, where are they going to go to work? Most of the people that go into pharma did not intend to go into pharma. They are, you know, sidesteppers. I think it's a great place because there are so many different types of jobs you can go into. You don't have to go into clinical studies. You can go into marketing. You can go into statistics. You can go into research. You can go into marketing of the products that are already on the market. You know, having a background in science is always a big help. And the big companies will give you training in the disease or in whatever, so help you to gain more tools so that you know you're you're talking about, the foundation of chemistry, biology, you know, any of the life sciences is wonderful. It's a really good opportunity because, as I say, we have so many doctors of biology, doctors of chemistry. What are they going to do?
Come to drug development, come to life sciences. That's great. All right. Well, Dr. Diana Sims Silberman, thank you so much for chatting with us today on Few and Far Between.
My pleasure. Yeah.
Congratulations on what has been a really fascinating career.
And my team gave me a farewell party. I get tears in my eyes when I think about it. It was so beautiful.
I'm sure that was fully deserved.
No, but it was a wonderful experience. I would do it again in a minute. And the message is learn, learn, learn.
I love that. Learn, learn, learn. That's the headline that we'll take away. Okay. Thank you, Diana.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of Few and Far Between. Our podcast is now available on Apple Podcasts and other major streaming services. Please take a moment and leave us a user review and rating today. It really helps people discover the podcast, and we read all the comments. Those comments help us to make Few and Far Between better and better. Also, be sure to subscribe to Few and Far Between so that you don't miss a single episode. Got an idea for a future episode? Email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. See you next time.